his devoted wife, was elected president. He was a champion of the descamisados, the shirtless ones, the workers and the poor, just as his wife was. Only 26 at the time, she had grown up in poverty herself. Now that this star was the first lady of the republic, she seemed to change. She lost weight, most definitely. Her outfits became less flamboyant, even downright austere. And that beautiful, flowing hair was now pulled back rather severely. It was a shame. The young star had grown up. But as Argentines saw more of the new Evita, as she was now known, her new look affected them more strongly. It was the look of a saintly, serious woman, one who was indeed what her husband called the bridge of love between himself and his people. She was now on the radio all the time, and listening to her was as emotional as ever, but she also spoke magnificently in public. Her voice was lower, and her delivery slower. She stabbed the air with her fingers, reached out as if to touch the audience. And her words pierced you to the core. Quote, I left my dreams by the wayside in order to watch over the dreams of others. I now place my soul at the side of the soul of my people. I offer them all my energies, so that my body may be a bridge erected toward the happiness of all. Pass over it, toward the supreme destiny of the new fatherland. Unquote. It was no longer only through magazines and the radio that Evita made herself felt. Almost everyone was personally touched by her in some way. Everyone seemed to know someone who had met her, or who had visited her in her office, where a line of supplicants wound its way through the hallways to her door. Behind her desk she sat, so calm and full of love. Film crews recorded her acts of charity. To a woman who had lost everything, Evita would give a house. To one with a sick child, free care in the finest hospital. She worked so hard. No wonder rumor had it that she was ill, and everyone heard of her visits to the shanty towns and to hospitals for the poor, where, against the wishes of her staff, she would kiss people with all kinds of maladies, lepers, syphilitic men, etc., on the cheek. Once an assistant, appalled by this habit, tried to dab Evita's lips with alcohol to sterilize them. This saint of a woman grabbed the bottle and smashed it against the wall. Yes, Evita was a saint, a living Madonna. Her appearance alone could heal the sick. And when she died of cancer in 1952, no outsider to Argentina could possibly understand the sense of grief and loss she left behind. For some, the country never recovered. Most of us live in a semi-somnambulistic state. We do our daily tasks, and the days fly by. The two exceptions to this are childhood and those moments when we are in love. In both cases, our emotions are more engaged, more open and active, and we equate feeling emotional with feeling more alive. A public figure who can affect people's emotions, who can make them feel communal sadness, joy, or hope, has a similar effect. An appeal to the emotions is far more powerful than an appeal to reason. Eva Perón knew this power early on as a radio actress. Her tremulous voice could make audiences weep. Because of this, people saw in her great charisma. She never forgot the experience. Her every public act was framed in dramatic and religious motifs. Drama is condensed emotion. And the Catholic religion is a force that reaches into your childhood, hits you where you cannot help yourself. Evita's uplifted arms, her staged acts of charity, her sacrifices for the common folk, all this went straight to the heart. It wasn't her goodness alone that was charismatic, although the appearance of goodness is alluring enough. It was her ability to dramatize her goodness. You must learn to exploit the two great purveyors of emotion, drama and religion. Drama cuts out the useless and banal in life, focusing on moments of pity and terror. Religion deals with matters of life and death. Make your charitable actions dramatic. Give your loving words religious import. Bathe everything in rituals and myths going back to childhood. Caught up in the emotions you stir, people will see over your head the halo of charisma. The Deliverer. In Harlem in the early 1950s, few African Americans knew much about the Nation of Islam or ever stepped into its temple. The nation preached that white people were descended from the devil and that someday Allah would liberate the black race. The doctrine had little meaning for Harlemites who went to church for spiritual solace and turned in practical matters to their local politicians. But in 1954, a new minister for the Nation of Islam arrived in Harlem. The minister's name was Malcolm X, and he was well-read and eloquent, yet his gestures and words were angry. Words spread. Whites had lynched Malcolm's father. He had grown up in a juvenile facility, then had survived as a small-time hustler before being arrested for burglary and spending 6 years in prison. His short life, he was only 29 at the time, had been one long run-in with the law. Yet look at him now, so confident and educated. No one had helped him. He had done it all on his own. Harlemites began to see Malcolm X everywhere, handing out flyers, addressing the young. He would stand outside their churches, and as the congregation dispersed, he would point to the preacher and say, "He represents the white man's God. I represent the black man's God." The curious began to come to hear him preach at a Nation of Islam temple. He would ask them to look at the actual conditions of their lives. When you get through looking at where you live, then take a walk across Central Park, he would tell them. Look at the white man's apartments. Look at his Wall Street. His words were powerful, particularly coming from a minister. In 1957, a young Muslim in Harlem witnessed the beating of a drunken black man by several policemen. When the Muslim protested, the police pummeled him senseless and carted him off to jail. An angry crowd gathered outside the police station, ready to riot. Told that only Malcolm X could forestall violence, the police commissioner brought him in and told him to break up the mob. Malcolm refused. Speaking more temperately, the commissioner begged him to reconsider. Malcolm calmly set conditions for his cooperation: medical care for the beaten Muslim and proper punishment for the police officers. The commissioner reluctantly agreed. Outside the station, Malcolm explained the agreement, and the crowd dispersed. In Harlem and around the country, he was an overnight hero. Finally, a man who took action. Membership in his temple soared. Malcolm began to speak all over the United States. He never read from a text. Looking out at the audience, he made eye contact, pointed his finger. His anger was obvious, not so much in his tone, he was always controlled and articulate, as in his fierce energy, the veins popping out on his neck. Many earlier black leaders had used cautious words and had asked their followers to deal patiently and politely with their social lot, no matter how unfair. What a relief Malcolm was. He ridiculed the racists. He ridiculed the liberals. He ridiculed the president. No white person escaped his scorn. If whites were violent, Malcolm said, the language of violence should be spoken back to them, for it was the only language they understood. "Hostility is good," he cried out. "It's been bottled up too long." In response to the growing popularity of the nonviolent leader, Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm said, "Anybody can sit. An old woman can sit. A coward can sit. It takes a man to stand." Malcolm X had a bracing effect on many who felt the same anger he did, but were frightened to express it. At his funeral, he He was assassinated in 1965 at one of his speeches. The actor, Ossie Davis, delivered the eulogy before a large and emotional crowd. "Malcolm," he said, "was our own black shining prince." Malcolm X was a charismatic of Moses's kind. He was a deliverer. The power of this sort of charismatic comes from his or her expression of dark emotions that have built up over years of oppression. In doing so, the deliverer provides an opportunity for the release of bottled up emotions by other people, of the hostility masked by forced politeness and smiles. Deliverers have to be one of the suffering crowd, only more so. Their pain must be exemplary. Malcolm's personal history was an integral part of his charisma. His lesson, that blacks should help themselves, not wait for whites to lift them up, meant a great deal more because of his own years in prison and because he had followed his own doctrine by educating himself, lifting himself up from the bottom. The deliverer must be a living example of personal redemption. The essence of charisma is an overpowering emotion that communicates itself in your gestures, in your tone of voice, in subtle signs that are the more powerful for being unspoken. You feel something more deeply than others, and no emotion is more powerful and more capable of creating a charismatic reaction than hatred, particularly if it comes from deep-rooted feelings of oppression. Express what others are afraid to express, and they will see great power in you. Say what they want to say, but cannot. Never be afraid of going too far. If you represent a release from oppression, you have the leeway to go still farther. Moses spoke of violence, of destroying every last one of his enemies. Language like this brings the oppressed together and makes them feel more alive. This is not, however, something that is uncontrollable on your part. Malcolm X felt rage from early on, but only in prison did he teach himself the art of oratory and how to channel his emotions. Nothing is more charismatic than the sense that someone is struggling with great emotion rather than simply giving into it. The Olympian Actor. On January 24, 1960, an insurrection broke out in Algeria, then still a French colony. Led by right-wing French soldiers, its purpose was to forestall the proposal of President Charles de Gaulle to grant Algeria the right of self-determination. If necessary, the insurrectionists would take over Algeria in the name of France. For several tense days, the 70-year-old de Gaulle maintained a strange silence. Then on January 29th at 8 in the evening, he appeared on French national television. Before he had uttered a word, the audience was astonished, for he wore his old uniform from World War II, a uniform that everyone recognized and that created a strong emotional response. De Gaulle had been the hero of the resistance, the savior of the country at its darkest moment. But that uniform had not been seen for quite some time. Then de Gaulle spoke, reminding his public in his cool and confident manner of all they had accomplished together in liberating France from the Germans. Slowly he moved from these charged patriotic issues to the rebellion in Algeria and the affront it presented to the spirit of the liberation. He finished his address by repeating his famous words of June 18, 1940. "Once again, I call all Frenchmen, wherever they are, whatever they are, to reunite with France. Vive la République! Vive la France!" The speech had two purposes. It showed that de Gaulle was determined not to give an inch to the rebels, and it reached for the heart of all patriotic Frenchmen, particularly in the army. The insurrection quickly died, and no one doubted the connection between its failure and de Gaulle's performance on television. The following year, the French voted overwhelmingly in favor of Algerian self-determination. On April 11, 1961, de Gaulle gave a press conference in which he made it clear that France would soon grant the country full independence. 11 days later, French generals in Algeria issued a communique stating that they had taken over the country and declaring a state of siege. This was the most dangerous moment of all. Faced with Algeria's imminent independence, these right-wing generals would go all the way. A civil war could break out, toppling de Gaulle's government. The following night, de Gaulle appeared once again on television, once again wearing his old uniform. He mocked the generals, comparing them to a South American junta. He talked calmly and sternly. Then suddenly, at the very end of the address, his voice rose and even trembled as he called out to the audience, "Française, Français, aidez-moi." French women, Frenchmen, help me. It was the most stirring moment of all his television appearances. French soldiers in Algeria listening on transistor radios were overwhelmed. The next day, they held a mass demonstration in favor of de Gaulle. 2 days later, the generals surrendered. On July 1, 1962, de Gaulle proclaimed Algeria's independence. In 1940, after the German invasion of France, de Gaulle escaped to England to recruit an army that would eventually return to France for the liberation. At the beginning, he was alone, and his mission seemed hopeless. But he had the support of Winston Churchill, and with Churchill's blessing, he gave a series of radio talks that the BBC broadcast to France. His strange, hypnotic voice, with its dramatic tremolos, would enter French living rooms in the evenings. Few of his listeners even knew what he looked like, but his tone was so confident, so stirring, that he recruited a silent army of believers. In person, de Gaulle was a strange, brooding man whose confident manner could just as easily irritate as win over. But over the radio, that voice had intense charisma. De Gaulle was the first great master of modern media, for he easily transferred his dramatic skills to television, where his iciness, his calmness, his total self-possession made audiences feel both comforted and inspired. The world has grown more fractured. A nation no longer comes together on the streets or in the squares. It is brought together in living rooms, where people watching television all over the country can simultaneously be alone and with others. Charisma must now be communicable over the airwaves, or it has no power. But it is in some ways easier to project on television, both because television makes a direct one-on-one appeal, the charismatic seems to address you, and because charisma is fairly easy to fake for the few moments you spend in front of the camera. As de Gaulle understood, when appearing on television, it's best to radiate calmness and control, to use dramatic effects sparingly. De Gaulle's overall iciness made doubly effective the brief moments in which he raised his voice or let loose a biting joke. By remaining calm and underplaying it, he hypnotized his audience. Your face can express much more if your voice is less strident. He conveyed emotion visually, the uniform, the setting, and through the use of certain charged words, the liberation, Joan of Arc. The less he strained for effect, the more sincere he appeared. All this must be carefully orchestrated. Punctuate your calmness with surprises. Rise to a climax. Keep things short and terse. The only thing that cannot be faked is self-confidence, the key component to charisma since the days of Moses. Should the camera lights betray your insecurity, all the tricks in the world will not put your charisma back together again. Dangers. On a pleasant May day in 1794, the citizens of Paris gathered in a park for the Festival of the Supreme Being. The focus of their attention was Maximilien de Robespierre, head of the Committee of Public Safety, and the man who had thought up the festival in the first place. The idea was simple: to combat atheism, quote, "to recognize the existence of a supreme being and the immortality of the soul as the guiding forces of the universe," unquote. It was Robespierre's day of triumph. Standing before the masses in his sky-blue suit and white stockings, he initiated the festivities. The crowd adored him. After all, he had safeguarded the purposes of the French Revolution through the intense politicking that had followed it. The year before, he had initiated the Reign of Terror, which cleansed the revolution of its enemies by sending them to the guillotine. He had also helped guide the country through a war against the Austrians and the Prussians. What made crowds, particularly women, love him was his incorruptible virtue. He lived very modestly. His refusal to compromise, the passion for the revolution that was evident in everything he did, and the romantic language of his speeches, which could not fail to inspire. He was a god. The day was beautiful and augured a great future for the revolution. 2 months later, on July 26th, Robespierre delivered a speech that he thought would ensure his place in history, for he intended to hint at the end of the Terror and a new era for France. Rumor also had it that he was to call for a last handful of people to be sent to the guillotine, a final group that threatened the safety of the revolution. Mounting the rostrum to address the country's governing convention, Robespierre wore the same clothes he had worn on the day of the festival. The speech was long, almost 3 hours, and included an impassioned description of the values and virtues he had helped protect. There was also talk of conspiracies, treachery, unnamed enemies. The response was enthusiastic, but a little less so than usual. The speech had tired many representatives. Then a lone voice was heard, that of a man named Bourdon, who spoke against printing Robespierre's speech, a veiled sign of disapproval. Suddenly, others stood up on all sides and accused him of vagueness. He had talked of conspiracies and threats without naming the guilty. Asked to be specific, he refused, preferring to name names later on. The next day, Robespierre stood to defend his speech, and the representatives shouted him down. A few hours later, he was the one sent to the guillotine. On July 28th, amid a gathering of citizens who seemed to be in an even more festive mood than at the Festival of the Supreme Being, Robespierre's head fell into the basket to resounding cheers. The reign of terror was over. Many of those who seemed to admire Robespierre actually harbored a gnawing resentment of him. He was so virtuous, so superior, it was oppressive. Some of these men had plotted against him and were waiting for the slightest sign of weakness, which appeared on that fateful day when he gave his last speech. In refusing to name his enemies, he had shown either a desire to end the bloodshed or a fear that they would strike at him before he could have them killed. Fed by the conspirators, this one spark turned into fire. Within 2 days, first a governing body and then a nation turned against a charismatic who 2 months before had been revered. Charisma is as volatile as the emotions it stirs. Most often, it stirs sentiments of love. But such feelings are hard to maintain. Psychologists talk of erotic fatigue, the moments after love in which you feel tired of it, resentful. Reality creeps in. Love turns to hate. Erotic fatigue is a threat to all charismatics. The charismatic often wins love by acting the savior, rescuing people from some difficult circumstance. But once they feel secure, charisma is less seductive to them. Charismatics need danger and risk. They aren't plodding bureaucrats. Some of them deliberately keep danger going, as de Gaulle and Kennedy were wont to do, or as Robespierre did through the Reign of Terror. But people tire of this, and at your first sign of weakness, they will turn on you. The love they showed before will be matched by their hatred now. The only defense is to master your charisma. Your passion, your anger, your confidence make you charismatic, but too much charisma for too long creates fatigue and a desire for calmness and order. The better kind of charisma is created consciously and is kept under control. When you need to, you can glow with confidence and fervor, inspiring the masses. But when the adventure is over, you can settle into a routine, turning the heat not out, but down. Robespierre may have been planning that move, but it came a day too late. People will admire your self-control and adaptability. Their love affair with you will move closer to the habitual affection of a man and wife. You will even have the leeway to look a little boring, a little simple. A role that can also seem charismatic if played correctly. Remember, charisma depends on success. And the best way to maintain success after the initial charismatic rush is to be practical and even cautious. Mao Zedong was a distant, enigmatic man who for many had an awe-inspiring charisma. He suffered many setbacks that would have spelled the end of a less clever man, but after each reversal, he retreated, becoming practical, tolerant, flexible, at least for a while. This protected him from the dangers of a counter-reaction. There is another alternative, to play the armed prophet. According to Machiavelli, although a prophet may acquire power through his charismatic personality, he cannot long survive without the strength to back it up. He needs an army. The masses will tire of him. They will need to be forced. Being an armed prophet may not literally involve arms, but it demands a forceful side to your character, which you can back up with action. Unfortunately, this means being merciless with your enemies for as long as you retain power. And no one creates more bitter enemies than the charismatic. Finally, there is nothing more dangerous than succeeding a charismatic. These characters are unconventional, and their rule is personal in style, being stamped with the wildness of their personalities. They often leave chaos in their wake. The one who follows after a charismatic is left with a mess, which the people, however, do not see. They miss their inspirer and blame the successor. Avoid this situation at all costs. If it is unavoidable, do not try to continue what the charismatic started. Go in a new direction. By being practical, trustworthy, and plain speaking, you can often generate a strange kind of charisma through contrast. That was how Harry Truman not only survived the legacy of Roosevelt, but established his own type of charisma. In conclusion, here are some further reflections on the charismatic. A quote from Max Weber. Charisma shall be understood to refer to an extraordinary quality of a person, regardless of whether this quality is actual, alleged, or presumed. Charismatic authority, hence, shall refer to a rule over men, whether predominantly external or predominantly internal, to which the governed submit because of their belief in the extraordinary quality of the specific person. From the Old Testament, Book of Exodus, chapter 34, verse 27. And the Lord said to Moses, Write these words. In accordance with these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel. And he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He neither ate bread nor drank water. And he wrote upon the tables the words of the covenant, the 10 commandments. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai, with the 2 tables of the testimony in his hand as he came down from the mountain, Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone because he had been talking with God. And when Aaron and all the people of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. But Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the leaders of the congregation returned to him, and Moses talked with them. And afterward all the people of Israel came near, and he gave them in commandment all that the Lord had spoken with him in Mount Sinai. And when Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil on his face. But whenever Moses went in before the Lord to speak with him, he took the veil off until he came out. And when he came out and told the people of Israel what he was commanded, the people of Israel saw the face of Moses, that the skin of Moses' face shone. And Moses would put the veil upon his face again until he went in to speak with him. A quote from General Van Damme on Napoleon Bonaparte. That devil of a man exercises a fascination on me that I cannot explain even to myself, and in such a degree that though I fear neither God nor devil when I am in his presence, I am ready to tremble like a child, and he could make me go through the eye of a needle to throw myself into the fire. A quote from Sigmund Freud. The masses have never thirsted after truth. They demand illusions and cannot do without them. They constantly give what is unreal precedence over what is real. They are almost as strongly influenced by what is untrue as by what is true. They have an evident tendency not to distinguish between the two. A quote by Vita Sackville-West from St. Joan of Arc. In such conditions, where half the battle was hand-to-hand, concentrated into a small space, the spirit and example of the leader counted for much. When we remember this, it becomes easier to understand the astonishing effect of Joan's presence upon the French troops. Her position as a leader was a unique one. She was not a professional soldier. She was not really a soldier at all. She wasn't even a man. She was ignorant of war. She was a girl dressed up. But she believed, and had made others willing to believe, that she was the mouthpiece of God. On Friday, April 29th, 1429, the news spread in Orléans that a force led by the Pucelle of Domremy was on its way to the relief of the city, a piece of news which, as the chronicler remarks, comforted them greatly. A quote by Norman Cohn from The Pursuit of the Millennium. Amongst the surplus population living on the margin of society in the Middle Ages, there was always a strong tendency to take as leader a layman, or maybe an apostate friar or monk, who imposed himself not simply as a holy man, but as a prophet, or even as a living god. On the strength of inspirations or revelations for which he claimed divine origin, this leader would decree for his followers a communal mission of vast dimensions and world-shaking importance. The conviction of having such a mission, of being divinely appointed to carry out a prodigious task, provided the disoriented and the frustrated with new bearings and new hope. It gave them not simply a place in the world, but a unique and resplendent place. A fraternity of this kind felt itself an elite, set infinitely apart from and above ordinary mortals, sharing also in his miraculous powers. A quote from Rasputin, The Holy Devil, by René Fulop Miller. How peculiar Rasputin's eyes are, confesses a woman who had made efforts to resist his influence. She goes on to say that every time she met him, she was always amazed afresh at the power of his glance, which it was impossible to withstand for any considerable time. There was something oppressive in this kind and gentle, but at the same time sly and cunning glance. People were helpless under the spell of the powerful will which could be felt in his whole being. However tired you might be of this charm, and however much you wanted to escape it, somehow or other you always found yourself attracted back and held. A young girl who had heard of the strange new saint came from her province to the capital and visited him in search of edification and spiritual instruction. She had never seen either him or a portrait of him before, and met him for the first time in his house. When he came up to her and spoke to her, she thought him like one of the peasant preachers she had often seen in her own country home. His gentle, monastic gaze and the plainly parted light brown hair around the worthy, simple face all at first inspired her confidence. But when he came nearer to her, she felt immediately that another quite different man, mysterious, crafty, and corrupting, looked out from behind the eyes that radiated goodness and gentleness. He sat down opposite her, edged quite close up to her, and his light blue eyes changed color and became deep and dark. A keen glance reached her from the corner of his eyes, bored into her, and held her fascinated. A leaden heaviness overpowered her limbs as his great wrinkled face, distorted with desire, came closer to hers. She felt his hot breath on her cheeks, and saw how his eyes, burning from the depths of their sockets, furtively roved over her helpless body until he dropped his lids with a sensuous expression. His voice had fallen to a passionate whisper, and he murmured strange, voluptuous words in her ear. Just as she was on the point of abandoning herself to her seducer, a memory stirred in her dimly, and as if from some far distance, she recalled that she had come to ask him about God. A quote by Max Weber. By its very nature, the existence of charismatic authority is specifically unstable. The holder may forego his charisma. He may feel forsaken by his God, as Jesus did on the cross. He may prove to his followers that virtue is gone out of him. It is then that his mission is extinguished, and hope waits and searches for a new holder of charisma. From Coriolanus by William Shakespeare. He is their God. He leads them like a thing made by some other deity than nature, that shapes man better, and they follow him against us brats with no less confidence than boys pursuing summer butterflies, or butchers killing flies. From a description of Elvis Presley's concert at the Hayride Theater in Shreveport, Louisiana, December 17, 1956. The roof did lift as Presley came on stage. He sang for 25 minutes while the audience erupted like Mount Vesuvius. I never saw such excitement and screaming in my entire life, ever before or since, said film director Hal Cantor. As an observer, he described being stunned by an exhibition of public mass hysteria, a tidal wave of adoration surging up from 9,000 people over the wall of police flanking the stage, up over the floodlights to the performer and beyond him, lifting him to frenzied heights of response. A quotation by A.N. Patresov. No one could so fire others with their plans. No one could so impose his will and conquer by force of his personality as this seemingly so ordinary and somewhat coarse man who lacked any obvious sources of charm. Neither Plekhanov nor Martov nor anyone else possessed the secret radiating from Lenin of positively hypnotic effect upon people. I would even say domination of them. Plekhanov was treated with deference. Martov was loved. But Lenin alone was followed unhesitatingly as the only indisputable leader. for only Lenin represented that rare phenomenon, especially rare in Russia, of a man of iron will and indomitable energy who combines fanatical faith in the movement, the cause, with no less faith in himself. A quotation from Joseph Stalin on meeting Lenin for the first time in 1905. I had hoped to see the mountain eagle of our party, the great man, great physically as well as politically. I had fancied Lenin as a giant, stately and imposing. How great was my disappointment to see a most ordinary-looking man, below average height, in no way, literally, in no way distinguishable from ordinary mortals. A quotation from Charles de Gaulle. First and foremost, there can be no prestige without mystery, for familiarity breeds contempt. In the design, the demeanor, and the mental operations of a leader, there must always be a something which others cannot altogether fathom, which puzzles them, stirs them, and rivets their attention, to hold in reserve some piece of secret knowledge which may any moment intervene, and the more effectively from being in the nature of a surprise. The latent faith of the masses will do the rest. Once the leader has been judged capable of adding the weight of his personality to the known factors of any situation, the ensuing hope and confidence will add immensely to the faith reposed in him. From Evita by Nicholas Fraser and Marissa Navarro. Only a month after Evita's death, the Newspaper Vendors Union put forth her name for canonization, and although this gesture was an isolated one, was never taken seriously by the Vatican, the idea of Evita's holiness remained with many people and was reinforced by the publication of devotional literature subsidized by the government, by the renaming of cities, schools, and subway stations, and by the stamping of medallions, the casting of busts, and the issuing of ceremonial stamps. The time of the evening news broadcast was changed from 8:30 p.m. to 8:25 p.m., the time when Evita had passed into immortality. And each month there were torch-lit processions on the 26th of the month, the day of her death. On the first anniversary of her death, La Prensa printed a story about one of its readers seeing Evita's face in the face of the moon. And after this, there were many more such sightings reported in the newspapers. For the most part, official publications stopped short of claiming sainthood for her, but their restraint was not always convincing. In the calendar for 1953 of the Buenos Aires newspaper vendors, as in other unofficial images, she was depicted in the traditional blue robes of the Virgin, her hands crossed, her sad head to one side, and surrounded by a halo. A quote from Napoleon Bonaparte. As for me, I have the gift of electrifying men. A quote from Malcolm X. I do not pretend to be a divine man, but I do believe in divine guidance, divine power, and divine prophecy. I am not educated, nor am I an expert in any particular field, but I am sincere, and my sincerity is my credentials. The Star. Daily life is harsh, and most of us constantly seek escape from it in fantasies and dreams. Stars feed on this weakness. Standing out from others through a distinctive and appealing style, they make us want to watch them. At the same time, they are vague and ethereal, keeping their distance and letting us imagine more than is there. Their dreamlike quality works on our unconscious. We are not even aware how much we imitate them. Learn to become an object of fascination by projecting the glittering but elusive presence of the star. The Fetishistic Star. One day in 1922, in Berlin, Germany, a casting call went out for the part of a voluptuous young woman in a film called Tragedy of Love. Of the hundreds of struggling young actresses who showed up, most would do anything to get the casting director's attention, including exposing themselves. There was one young woman in the line, however, who was simply dressed and performed none of the other girls' desperate antics, yet she stood out anyway. The girl carried a puppy on a leash and had draped an elegant necklace around the puppy's neck. The casting director noticed her immediately. He watched her as she stood in line, calmly holding the dog in her arms and keeping to herself. When she smoked a cigarette, her gestures were slow and suggestive. He was fascinated by her legs and face, the sinuous way she moved, the hint of coldness in her eyes. By the time she had come to the front, he had already cast her. Her name was Marlene Dietrich. By 1929, when the Austrian-American director Joseph von Sternberg arrived in Berlin to begin work on the film The Blue Angel, the 27-year-old Dietrich was well known in the Berlin film and theater world. The Blue Angel was to be about a woman called Lola Lola, who preys sadistically on men, and all of Berlin's best actresses wanted the part, except, apparently, Dietrich, who made it known that she thought the role demeaning. Von Sternberg should choose from the other actresses he had in mind. Shortly after arriving in Berlin, however, von Sternberg attended a performance of a musical to watch a male actor he was considering for the Blue Angel. The star of the musical was Dietrich, and as soon as she came on stage, von Sternberg found that he couldn't take his eyes off her. She stared at him directly, insolently, like a man, and then there were those legs and the way she leaned provocatively against the wall. Von Sternberg forgot about the actor he had come to see. He had found his Lola Lola. Von Sternberg managed to convince Dietrich to take the part, and immediately he went to work, molding her into the Lola of his imagination. He changed her hair, drew a silver line down her nose to make it seem thinner, taught her to look at the camera with the insolence he had seen on stage. When filming began, he created a lighting system just for her, a light that tracked her wherever she went and was strategically heightened by gauze and smoke. Obsessed with his creation, he followed her everywhere. No one else could go near her. The Blue Angel was a huge success in Germany. Audiences were fascinated with Dietrich, that cold, brutal stare as she spread her legs over a stool, baring her underwear. Her effortless way of commanding attention on screen. Others besides von Sternberg became obsessed with her. A man dying of cancer, Count Sascha Kolorat, had one last wish, to see Marlena's legs in person. Dietrich obliged, visiting him in the hospital and lifting up her skirt. He sighed and said, "Thank you, now I can die happy." Soon, Paramount Studios brought Dietrich to Hollywood, where everyone was quickly talking about her. At a party, all eyes would turn toward her when she came into the room. She would be escorted by the most handsome men in Hollywood, and would be wearing an outfit both beautiful and unusual. Gold lamé pajamas, a sailor suit with a yachting cap. The next day, the look would be copied by women all over town. Next, it would spread to magazines, and a whole new trend would start. The real object of fascination, however, was unquestionably Dietrich's face. What had enthralled von Sternberg was her blankness. With a simple lighting trick, he could make that face do whatever he wanted. Dietrich eventually stopped working with von Sternberg, but never forgot what he had taught her. One night in 1951, the director Fritz Lang, who was about to direct her in the film Rancho Notorious, was driving past his office when he saw a light flash in the window. Fearing a burglary, he got out of his car, crept up the stairs, and peeked through the crack in the door. It was Dietrich, taking pictures of herself in the mirror, studying her face from every angle. Marlene Dietrich had a distance from her own self. She could study her face, her legs, her body, as if she were someone else. This gave her the ability to mold her look, transforming her appearance for effect. She could pose in just the way that would most excite a man, her blankness letting him see her according to his fantasy, whether of sadism, voluptuousness, or danger. And every man who met her or who watched her on screen fantasized endlessly about her. The effect worked on women as well. In the words of one writer, she projected sex without gender. But this self-distance gave her a certain coldness, whether on film or in person. She was like a beautiful object, something to fetishize and admire the way we admire a work of art. The fetish is an object that commands an emotional response and that makes us breathe life into it. Because it is an object, we can imagine whatever we want to about it. Most people are too moody, complex, and reactive to let us see them as objects that we can fetishize. The power of the fetishistic star comes from an ability to become an object, and not just any object, but an object we fetishize, one that stimulates a variety of fantasies. Fetishistic stars are perfect, like the statue of a Greek god or goddess. The effect is startling and seductive. Its principal requirement is self-distance. If you see yourself as an object, then others will too. An ethereal, dreamlike air will heighten the effect. You are a blank screen. Float through life non-committally, and people will want to seize you and consume you. Of all the parts of your body that draw this fetishistic attention, the strongest is the face. So learn to tune your face like an instrument, making it radiate a fascinating vagueness for effect. And since you will have to stand out from other stars in the sky, you will need to develop an attention-getting style. Dietrich was the great practitioner of this art. Her style was chic enough to dazzle, weird enough to enthrall. Remember, your own image and presence are materials you can control. The sense that you are engaged in this kind of play will make people see you as superior and worthy of imitation. The Mythic Star. On July 2, 1960, a few weeks before that year's Democratic National Convention, former President Harry Truman publicly stated that John F. Kennedy, who had won enough delegates to be chosen his party's candidate for the presidency, was too young and inexperienced for the job. Kennedy's response was startling. He called a press conference to be televised live and nationwide on July 4th. The conference's drama was heightened by the fact that he was away on vacation, so that no one saw or heard from him until the event itself. Then, at the appointed hour, Kennedy strode into the conference room like a sheriff entering Dodge City. He began by stating that he had run in all of the state primaries, at considerable expense of money and effort, and had beaten his opponents fairly and squarely. Who was Truman to circumvent the democratic process? "This is a young country," Kennedy went on, his voice getting louder, "founded by young men, and still young at heart. The world is changing. The old ways will not do. It is time for a new generation of leadership to cope with new problems and new opportunities." Even Kennedy's enemies agreed that his speech that day was stirring. He turned Truman's challenge around. The issue was not his inexperience, but the older generation's monopoly on power. His style was as eloquent as his words, for his performance evoked films of the time, Alan Ladd in Shane confronting the corrupt older ranchers, or James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause. Kennedy even resembled Dean, particularly in his air of cool detachment. A few months later, now approved as the Democrats' presidential candidate, Kennedy squared off against his Republican opponent, Richard Nixon, in their first nationally televised debate. Nixon was sharp. He knew the answers to the questions and debated with aplomb, quoting statistics on the accomplishments of the Eisenhower administration, in which he had served as vice president. But beneath the glare of the cameras, on black-and-white television, he was a ghastly figure. His 5 o'clock shadow covered up with powder, streaks of sweat on his brow and cheeks, his face drooping with fatigue, his eyes shifting and blinking, his body rigid. What was he so worried about? The contrast with Kennedy was startling. If Nixon looked only at his opponent, Kennedy looked out at the audience, making eye contact with his viewers, addressing them in their living rooms as no politician had ever done before. If Nixon talked data and niggling points of debate, Kennedy spoke of freedom, of building a new society, of recapturing America's pioneer spirit. His manner was sincere and emphatic. His words were not specific, but he made his listeners imagine a wonderful future. The day after the debate, Kennedy's poll numbers soared miraculously, and wherever he went he was greeted by crowds of young girls, screaming and jumping. His beautiful wife, Jackie, by his side, he was a kind of Democratic prince. Now his television appearances were events. He was in due course elected president, and his inaugural address, also broadcast on television, was stirring. It was a cold and wintry day. In the background, Eisenhower sat huddled in coat and scarf, looking old and beaten. But Kennedy stood hatless and coatless to address the nation. "I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it, and the glow from that fire can truly light the world." Over the months to come, Kennedy gave innumerable live press conferences before the TV cameras, something no previous president had dared. Facing the firing squad of lenses and questions, he was unafraid, speaking coolly and slightly ironically. What was going on behind those eyes, that smile? People wanted to know more about him. The magazines teased its readers with information, photographs of Kennedy with his wife and children, or playing football on the White House lawn, interviews creating a sense of him as a devoted family man, yet one who mingled as an equal with glamorous stars. The images all melted together. The space race, the Peace Corps, Kennedy facing up to the Soviets during the Cuban Missile Crisis, just as he had faced up to Truman. After Kennedy was assassinated, Jackie said in an interview that before he went to bed, he would often play the soundtracks to Broadway musicals, and his favorite of these was Camelot, with its lines, "Don't let it be forgot that once there was a spot for one brief shining moment that was known as Camelot." "There would be great presidents again," Jackie said, "but never another Camelot." The name Camelot seemed to stick, making Kennedy's 1,000 days in office resonate as myth. Kennedy's seduction of the American public was conscious and calculated. It was also more Hollywood than Washington, which wasn't surprising. Kennedy's father, Joseph, had once been a movie producer, and Kennedy himself had spent time in Hollywood, hobnobbing with actors and trying to figure out what made them stars. He was particularly fascinated with Gary Cooper, Montgomery Clift, and Cary Grant. He often called Grant for advice. Hollywood had found ways to unite the entire country around certain themes or myths, often the great American myth of the West. The great stars embodied mythic types: John Wayne, the patriarch; Clift, the Promethean rebel; Jimmy Stewart, the noble hero; Marilyn Monroe, the siren. These were not mere mortals, but gods and goddesses to be dreamed and fantasized about. All of Kennedy's actions were framed in the conventions of Hollywood. He did not argue with his opponents. He confronted them dramatically. He posed, and in visually fascinating ways, whether with his wife, with his children, or alone on stage. He copied the facial expressions, the presence of a Dean or a Cooper. He did not discuss policy details, but waxed eloquent about grand, mythic themes, the kind that could unite a divided nation. And all this was calculated for television, for Kennedy mostly existed as a televised image. That image haunted our dreams. Well before his assassination,